I get to see Kevin Farmer's smiling face for the first time in a few weeks here after we had a week off and he wasn't able to come in. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Darren.
Nice to see you in studio.
It's nice to be back.
All right. So we're talking with a couple things today. Kevin, of course, is going to join us throughout for a couple of pieces of news. He may or may not also choose to jump in on some of the interviews. We'll see. But he's going to be in studio with me all day today, so you can look forward to his sunny disposition all throughout the entire hour today. We're going to speak first at the top of the show here to David York, who's a local filmmaker. He is the producer, director, and writer of a CBC Nature of Things documentary coming up Thursday, April 4th, which is called The Beatles Are Coming. It does sound a little bit like it's a 1960s cheesy horror movie. I actually was able to see a sneak preview of the documentary, and it kind of comes off that way too, not because of giant cartoon aliens or anything like that, but because it paints a pretty scary picture that seems hard to believe. I think if you did the whole documentary with sort of like an animated cover on it, you could easily make it a horror movie just by omitting some of the director talking over it. It's pretty scary stuff, but we're going to hopefully learn a little bit more and hopefully pick out some shiny pieces from that as well, because it's pretty grim. We're of course talking about the Beatles refer to the pine beetle, which is destroying forests on the west, has now spread to Alberta and may in fact eventually spread to Ontario. So David York's going to start the program telling us a little bit more about that. After we do some news and hear some wonderful music, which as usual this week has been provided by DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog, just a reminder as well that you can go and check all the links to all our features and stories and music as well on the website afterwards, which is greenmajority.ca, or if you want to have a look for last week while you're listening, maybe you can listen to two shows at the same time, I don't know. You can go ahead and do that now if you wanted. Also join the Facebook. We're going to be talking to, in the second half, Jim Harris, who is a sort of, I guess, green motivational speaker a little bit. He's put out a few books, one of which was called Blindsided. The most recent one is called A Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste. He's going to talk to us a little bit about his experience talking to businesses, trying to encourage sustainability in a real sense at a foundational level, and also just some of his personal experience. He's had over 20 years experience as a professional speaker and consultant, and will share some of his learning and some of his lessons that he's learned from his experience in the program. That will be in the second half. However, we are going to start, as I said, with filmmaker David York, who, do I have him on the line?
You do.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you.
So I was actually able to watch nearly all of your documentary this morning right before I came in. As I was describing, I don't know if you caught my intro there, but it's a bit grim.
Well, it's grim in that it paints a difficult picture of the mountain pine beetle outbreak in British Columbia and Alberta, and also, you know, projects a strong possibility that the outbreak will continue all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. But on the other hand, it's a miraculous species. The mountain pine beetle is an extraordinary creature, and you kind of have to admire it in a funny way.
One of the kind of early things that goes over in the documentary was talking about how the trees aren't sort of simply like passive victims, that there is actually, that the pine trees specifically that they've been attacking have evolved in essence along with the beetle and have varieties of defenses, and you go through and explain all those. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which trees have tried to prevent themselves and then what has actually overcome that? How has the beetle been able to come these defenses that the trees have?
Well, even backing up there from there, the mountain pine beetle and the lodgepole pine, which is its favorite host, have co-evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. And in fact, the beetle is an absolutely critical part of the natural process of forest renewal. The beetle's job is to take out over-mature 80 to 100-year pine trees, kill them. Those trees fall, they rot, providing the soil with nutrients and opening up the canopy for new trees. And then wildfire comes through and sweeps out the deadfall. And that's how pine trees have renewed themselves for millennium. So the tree's defenses are threefold. First of all, the tree has very thick bark, which is difficult for the beetle to chew its way through. Once it does, the tree expresses its pine pitch. So pine pitch kind of pours out the boreholes that the beetles have made in the tree. And for a period of a day, maybe two, the beetle finds itself kind of swimming upstream through this thick pine pitch that the tree's pouring out, trying to defend itself and seal the hole. So the beetles, when they attack a tree, they don't do it individually. They attack trees in hundreds, maybe thousands numbers. So after a couple of days, the tree literally has no more pitch with which to defend itself. So the beetle, you know, gets inside, gets under the bark. The next step of the tree's defense is to pour a very toxic version of its pine pitch into the tissue surrounding the beetle and kill off that tissue and, in effect, trap the beetle in this form of cell suicide. But if the beetle attacks in sufficient numbers, the tree simply doesn't have any defenses left. And after 48 hours or so, the tree's dead.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really stood out for me, I mean, just listening to the way, and there's some really beautiful imagery in there as well. It made it very easy to sort of understand and gripping to follow along to just even the story of how the beetles attack and then how the trees were defending themselves. But one of the things that stood out for me was during that process, I got a sense of just even thinking about the tree as an active defender sort of changed my perspective a little bit. I'm of course aware that trees are alive and natural things have natural defenses, but it seemed quite a bit more, I guess real is not even the right word. It just more in action. Like it was actually responding to stimuli as opposed to you think trees of like as like passive or like them defending themselves by maybe like scattering more tree seeds. But this it really made it sound like an actual sort of battleground that was going on.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's both a physical battleground in the beetle having to fight its way through the pitch, but it's also essentially a chemical warfare zone because the pitch is very toxic to the beetles and the sort of the chemical is called a terpene, and that's what turpentine used to be made of, and that's that really familiar scent of pine pitch that we all know. But the terpenes that sort of carry out this autonomous cell suicide around those beetles that have penetrated the bark, that's extraordinarily toxic both for the beetle and for any eggs and larvae that follow. So it's an extraordinary defense, and the beetle can only overcome it if it attacks in mass numbers all at the same time.
And so that's a really good place to stop, actually. I'm glad that you finished that sentence with mass numbers, because that was the next thing I wanted to ask you about flesh out a little bit more was the types of numbers that we're talking about. I heard numbers in there in the trillions.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an extraordinary event that happened in 2004. It was always thought that while the mountain pine beetle attack was devastating in British Columbia, the rest of the country's pine forests were safe because they couldn't cross the Rockies. And there's a fellow named Peter Jackson who's a meteorologist at the University of Northern British Columbia. And he saw these strange-looking cloud formations on his weather radar, and they would last a couple of days. And they weren't rain. And he had a suspicion that they might be insects. Rented a Cessna and went out for a closer look. And he took some samples over a 1-hectare area of these clouds of beetles.
There's actually I remember a harrowing image a little bit of him actually like opening the door of an airplane while in flight and sticking a net out the side of the window. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And he extrapolated the numbers out from his sample, and in one cloud crossing over the Rockies in a 4-day stretch in outside Prince George, he counted over 600 million beetles. And extrapolating from there over all of the flights that he knew were in the air in British Columbia that single weekend, he gets up to around 2.5 trillion beetles in the air in one weekend.
Wow. And so, like, when we're talking about the actual threat from that, I mean, numbers, when you get into something like numbers in the trillions, I mean, you can see, when you see the documentary, you'll see what they show the radar image of these clouds. He has the kind of recorded image, and it really does look like a weather system moving through. But again, I think it's still like a problem of like scale. Like, we're not used to sort of thinking about insect numbers in the trillions, and we're not used to thinking about the numbers of individual trees in a massive forest. So can you give me and the listeners just a little bit of an idea about like the type of area that's been affected so far, and then the type of area that potentially could be affected?
Oh, sure. So the outbreak took off in British Columbia in 1999. And the sort of peak outbreak years were 1999 through 2007. And in that period of time, the mountain pine beetle took out 18 million hectares of pine trees. Now, that is an area equal to the provinces of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. So that's essentially hollowing out the central interior, the northern half of the central interior of British Columbia, and denuding it of its pine forests.
It should also be noted as well is that obviously the pine beetles don't respect things like national parks, so this isn't just going after reducing income for loggers or anything like that. I mean, we're literally talking about either between the beetles or between the attempts to contain them, like clear-cutting areas the size of Nova Scotia, you're saying?
Yeah, well, the beetle outbreak took out 18 million hectares of trees the size of Nova Scotia. And mm-hmm. Not all of that has been clear-cut,
right.
Although much of it has, which is a part I'm sure we'll get to later. But yeah, absolutely, one of the first nodes of the outbreak that was noticed was in Tweedsmuir Park, which is a spectacular, pristine wilderness area in the northern interior of BC, and that is basically doesn't have any more pine trees in it anymore.
And so, what's going to happen to those spaces? I mean, now that we have big swaths, are these kind of like permanent biohazard areas, is it just going to turn into kind of farmland for now? What is actually happening to these massive areas that are cut down to try and contain the infestation?
Okay. Well, the first thing that the first kind of dilemma that the province of British Columbia and its logging industry faced is they looked at these millions of hectares of dead pine trees, and they knew that those pine trees had economic value as timber for a period of about 5 to 8 years before they fell and rotted. So the province of British Columbia's first response was to increase the cut block size, lower the stumpage fees, and set the logging industry loose on this vast area of dead pine trees. So, off they went. And over the course of it, there was a massive investment in milling infrastructure to the extent that 5 of the world's top 10 sawmills are in the northern interior of BC. And they're pretty much solely devoted to processing beetle-killed pine. So, where we stand now is this clear-cutting activity has been going on for, call it a decade, and these mills are 3 to 5 years away from exhausting that supply of dead timber. What's happened is because that supply is almost exhausted, those mills have started cutting other species of conifer. They've started going after spruce, and they've started going after fir. So it really is a kind of a full-scale attack on the conifer landscape in British Columbia that's going on. The impact of that is disastrous. There was a recent study that said there are 70% fewer moose, for instance, in the pine beetle outbreak area. The flooding situation is disastrous because a healthy pine pine tree pumps 8 gallons of water per hour during spring melt. So if you take all of those pine trees out of the mix, it plays havoc with the watershed. So the Fraser had a horrific flooding year this year. They're looking at century floods now happening every 7 to 15 years in the Fraser, which is a disaster. The pine tree is also a keystone species in that environment, which means it's a species that all life depend on. So if you take out the pine tree, it's got disastrous impacts on songbirds, on fish, other plants, ungulates. It really is quite devastating what's going on.
Hi, David. This is Kevin. I've been aware for years that the pine beetle infestation is one of Canada's really sort of unknown ecological catastrophes. My understanding has been, though, that in the past, cold winters helped to curb the population of the beetles, and in fact, you know, that increasingly mild winters now are contributing to the population explosion. Can you speak to that?
You're quite right, Kevin. So the natural cycle of forest life, every 25-30 years, historically, there was a warmish winter and a hot, dry summer. The beetle population would spike. It would then have the numbers to take out those old, over-mature standing pine and, you know, regenerate the forest in the way that I've talked about. But you could always count on a stretch of cold weather, basically below minus 35 or below for 4 or 5 days. That's enough to kill, 90 to 95% of the beetles. Also, the beetles have an extraordinary defense. In the mid-fall, they pump the water out of their larvae and replace it with, they use trizone chemistry and replace the water with essentially antifreeze that helps them over winter. But if there's a good cold snap right around Halloween, that will be fatal to every single mountain pine beetle in the forest.
And
the problem is that we haven't had those kind of, they haven't had those kind of winter conditions in British Columbia since the early 90s.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what's happened is cold weather, normal winters, always acted as a break on the population. So the population would spike for a year or two, and then it would kind of fall back drastically. That cold weather break has gone. So there's nothing in the natural cycle to restrain these beetle population outbreaks.
And what has changed also that suddenly allows these beetles to cross the Rockies? I always knew that was a natural barrier, but I never knew. I'm very interested to find out why they're suddenly able to surmount that barrier.
Numbers.
Just numbers, is
mass
it?
Mass numbers.
Right.
Once you get up north of, there's also the Rocky Mountain Plateau around, I don't know if you're familiar with the area, around Prince George, over to Chetwynd, B.C. There's actually a low pass, which is called Pine Pass. And so that's only at around 3,500, 4,000 feet. So that's where the beetles blew over Pine Pass.
Uh-huh.
And there were so many of them that, a sizable enough proportion of them landed that were able to take root in the pine forest on the other side of the Rockies.
All right. Well, I mean,
That's been the game changer. You know, now the mountain pine beetle is established east of the Rockies at an endemic level. It's there now. So all that needs to happen is a period of those warmer winters and hot, dry summers, and the outbreak will take off again.
I'm afraid we are actually getting pretty close to out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance. Was there any good news at all from this? Any hope? Are we just terribly concerned today? Is there anything looking up as far as strategies that are being developed or methodology? Does anybody have a lead to get a handle on this?
Well, the short answer is no. the short answer is no, because the beetle spends all but 2 days of its life cycle under the bark of a tree. and the only way to get at it is to cut individually infected trees down and burn them before the beetles emerge next summer. So that's, you know, when we're talking millions, if not billions of trees. So that's, you know, that's a kind of Herculean task. The thing, though, that we should take away from it is that it's not an invasive species. The beetle has always been in the forest doing this job. It's had periodic outbreaks in the past. This is natural, right? So what we're looking at right now is the fact that nature is, in effect, a more efficient logger than people are.
Well,
this is what the beetle's always done.
One of the things that I really appreciated about it was that there was a lot of really interesting imagery, a lot of close-up shots. So you really made it, when I was watching, you really made it very easy to sort of visualize exactly what it was that you were talking about. So I would definitely recommend it for folks. It will be airing. The first shot will be this coming Thursday, April the 4th at 8 p.m. That's 8:30. Was that the actual time? Did I get
that? Yeah, no, you got that right.
It's April 4th. Okay, so yeah, 8 o'clock. And then it's the replaying, I think, the following week or something like that. But
it's replaying on Saturday on Newsworld.
That's right.
Saturday.
So do you want to, aside from that, they can check that on CBC's The Nature of Things with David Suzuki, Thursday, April 4th at 8. Do you want to give people any information for a website they can look for information or a way to contact you if they're interested?
Well, there is. CBC does have a good website. The Nature of Things website is up, and they have a mini site with some additional material on. So if you just go to Nature of Things website, you'll see it.
Okay. Well, we'll also have links up to all of that on the post after the show as well. So if anyone doesn't have access to a computer now, just go and check our website later. You'll be able to find links to all this information as well. Thank you so much, David York, for joining us today on behalf of the film The Beetles Are Coming.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to go to a music break. We're going to hang out with Amber Wave's pick for this week for a couple of minutes, and we'll be right back to do some news headlines with Kevin, and then later on we'll be talking to Jim Harris. Stay tuned.
If you should fall to pieces, you know I'll pick them up. There are so many reasons I'm never gonna get enough. If you should leave this country, you know I'll come to you. Because you always love me. Oh, what I wouldn't do. Oh, what I wouldn't do.
Oh, what I wouldn't.
And we are back. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority, Canada's Environmental News Hour. We're broadcasting on, in addition to iTunes and our website, we're also live here at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, as well as our 18 wonderful and delicious, fantastic syndicates across the country from St. John's, Newfoundland to Vancouver, BC. And I am going to be, once again, joined by Kevin Farmer, who's here to tell us a little bit about some of the news items. Kevin, what grabbed your attention this week?
Well, a few things did, but first, just referring to our last your last interview, I just want to make a small correction to something that David said towards the end, referring to this pine beetle infestation as being quote unquote natural. I'd like to point out that while it's true the pine beetle is an indigenous species, it's no longer living what we would call its natural life cycle, and in fact, given that it never crossed the rock in hundreds of thousands of years, it had never crossed the Rocky Mountains before. It in fact is an invasive species now in the ecosystems for which it was not, within which it was not previously established. Mm-hmm. And we can attribute the outbreak in the infestation, the complete and utter outbreak, population explosion of these beetles in British Columbia to climate change, because the milder winters are no longer killing off the populations. And we can attribute, and as David informed me, it's the sheer numbers of beetles that are allowing them to cross the Rocky Mountains. So we can trace, you know, that becomes the vector for the infestation in Alberta is still climate change, because it's the climate change that's producing those numbers. So I would just take issue with that word that this is natural. This is an impact of climate change. It's another canary dying in a coal mine. Mm-hmm. And we have to, you know, and for all the climate deniers, Harper government, that are out there, you know, let's just ask ourselves, what's the economic impact of losing every pine tree in Canada, which is really now there's no natural barriers left to stop the eastward march of this beetle, like David said, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. So what's to stop it?
Yeah, and well, and to throw him a bone, I think what he meant by the fact that it was natural was that this is something that happened because, you know, nature decided, well, this is what's happening. Like, and sort of like, you know, humans caused climate change, but now that the climate has changed, their reaction to that change is entirely understandable. So it's not like they've decided to go to war with the humans. They're just following their patterns. But absolutely, because we changed the system by which their patterns operate, this is the result that we
what's,
get.
What's unnatural is climate change. That's the only point I wanted to make.
Yeah. And so this is a great place to remind you, because you said cough, cough, Harper government there, an excellent place where I like to occasionally remind our listeners that we are a 100% unbiased, non-political show. That doesn't prevent us from making political comments, though. And the reason I did that was not because I thought that there was anything wrong with Kevin saying cough, cough, is because all our news items today are pretty much all complaining about the Harper conservatives. So I just wanted to restate, we would be just as mad if anybody else was doing this stuff, and we would be super thrilled if they weren't.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
has nothing to do with the political parties whatsoever. However, unfortunately, as the powers that be, when you make bad decisions, that means we complain about you. So take it away with some complaining about the Harpers. Now that we said we're not political.
Well, I'm still kind of experiencing cognitive dissonance with regards to Joe Oliver's the Minister of Natural Resources, Joe Oliver's ongoing PR campaign lobbying for pipelines, both in the U.S. and lobbying for tankers, access for tankers out in British Columbia, where there's, you know, the plan is to increase to move the extend the Northern Gateway pipeline through BC, where it will reach the coast, and tankers that can now will navigate the waters will take the oil to Asian markets. And in the States, he's just taken to calling the tar sands green. He's just started labeling it green, and there's no justification for that. He's just saying Canada's green. And now the argument is, and you have to realize there's intense lobbying going on in Ottawa. Like all manner of MP and provincial premiers have been to Ottawa to lobby for the Keystone XL pipeline, which will allow the tar sands to reach the Gulf, and what the argument is now, that this is the new line from the Harper government, is that Canada is an environmental leader. We are a green country. We have impeccable green credentials. Even if that were true, like, almost don't even get me started on that line. But even if that were true, think about the cognitive dissonance it takes to say that. We are a green country, so by all means, allow us to exploit these tar sands, the dirtiest form of oil that can be found on Earth. We're a green country, so give us the go-ahead to excavate all of Alberta and destroy, you know, the Athabasca River and send pollution and carcinogens spilling into the Great Lakes. It's because we're green that we should be allowed to do this. If we were green, this wouldn't be on the table. If we were green, we wouldn't be developing the tar sands at all. If we were green, we would say, oh my God, thank God that bomb of carbon is on our soil and some unscrupulous dictator or corrupt petrostate isn't going to unleash it into the atmosphere. But no, we're saying somehow that because we're green, it should be okay for us to go ahead with this you know, megalithic project.
I think it's really, really funny that you put that way. It's like sort of imagining, like, well, you know, good thing the tar sands are in Canada because, you know, God help us if name a country had control of it. What would any country you could name? North Korea. Let's pick them at
Saudi
random.
Saudi Arabia.
Let's pick a country at random that we think is like less green than us and maybe is less moral. We like to think of ourselves Canadians as being very moral, you know, upstanding citizens. So, like, what could another country, pick the worst country you can think of, whatever you decided to be, you know, we're just, I picked North Korea at random because pretty much nobody will hate on me for hating North Korea. Just a safe bet. So, okay, you know, North Korea is in charge. What would they do with it? They develop it.
They do exactly
what it is that we're doing.
Exactly.
What is the worst option? Oh, thank goodness we're developing it because otherwise somebody might have not developed it.
Right.
What's the argument? I don't even understand. You know, you're talking about, like, and I think there is, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance I'm brain farting on the guy's name all of a sudden. I can't imagine. The Daily Show,
Jon Stewart,
was saying something about, lying. You don't have to lie if you just change the definition of words. and it's like what you're talking about. It's like, well, I'm just calling that green. Well, how is it green? Well, I don't know. It's green. I just called it green. Therefore, it's green.
Yeah. And the line he's using out in BC now is that a tanker spill simply can't happen. It will never happen. He has assured British Columbia that there will never be a tanker spill in BC's coastal waters. And admittedly, the protocols for shipping oil through Canada now are vastly superior to those protocols that were in place during the time of the Exxon Valdez. But to just simply go there and say with a straight face that a spill is impossible because we have double-hulled tankers now and the pilot has to be on duty and they're guided by tugboats. You know, they said that about the Clearwater Horizon.
It's my turn to cough. Titanic.
yeah, exactly. it's just this bald-faced branding of oil. Rather than deal with the environment, they've just decided to co-opt it, and they're just co-opting. This is just greenwashing on an unbelievable scale.
Well, and I have to say we better move on actually. But I just want to get one more final comment. Have you heard of the group we've mentioned on the show before, Ethical Oil, quote unquote? The pro-oil lobby that
it's an umbrella group for carbon lobbyists.
Yeah, there's established connections to Harper government officials, like, you know, not backroom stuff, but like it's like a friend of his that runs it, stuff like that. I have to get on the details. There's lots of stuff. I know Environmental Defense and Sierra Club have put out a lot of stuff on that.
Right.
I wanted to offer them, I actually contacted them, and I wanted to offer them a chance to respond to those claims. Because again, you know, like, for instance, Greenpeace, unfortunately, is a guilty of this a lot of time, where it's they massage some stuff, and I like they're still on the right side as far as we're concerned, but they're an example of sometimes they maybe overemphasize certain points, and they, you know, they try and make their argument look as good as possible, and I think they've been caught slightly dishonestly doing that a couple of times. I still largely support most of their I entirely support almost all of their initiatives, and I still largely support them as a group, but you know, it's sometimes we have biases, you know, you and I have our own individual biases, and that colors what you're saying. So I wanted to offer them, I said, you know, we've heard a lot from the environment group saying that you're not, you know, legitimate. I would like you an opportunity to say what you think. And I was going to offer them. I said, you can write a statement and I would read it for you. If you'd like, I mean, I'd love to get somebody on air for an interview. If you want, I'll even let you come on and read a statement and then get off the air and then just let us talk about it. Whatever you want, but would you like to respond to these charges? And somebody actually did get back to me, but what they eventually said was, well, what do you want to talk about? And I was more specific, and I told them what I just said. And the response so far, I'm still waiting. There's a chance they could get back to me, but it's been like over a month now, was essentially, well, we've already responded to those. On the section on your website where you just said it was a lie and moved on. Like, I was trying to actually, like, I don't know. And so it's this sort of idea about, you know, guilty people like to, it's called... what's it called?
Minimization.
No. When you're doing something and so you accuse the other person of doing it. A projection.
Oh, yeah.
It's classic projection of just saying, well, you know, we're not this, we're not that. Okay, well, you don't actually have any arguments. You're just saying that.
Yeah.
I'd like to know why that's the case. And essentially, when I asked the follow-up, well, why? Can you please explain this? That was the last email that I got. So,
right, yeah.
That's not proof that anybody's corrupt. I'm not saying, haha, that's not a gotcha. I'm just like, well, if you want people who have serious questions about this, if they do really think that they're on the right side of this issue, then you've got to have an argument. And all I did was ask you what your argument was, and you won't talk to me. So if you are a legitimate organization, Ethical Oil, if you're listening, you're doing a really bad job of making people think that you are. Because a legitimate organization wouldn't be afraid of questions.
Exactly.
I'm just saying. And that doesn't prove that they're illegitimate. I'm just saying you're doing a really good job of convincing me that it's just an industry-funded BS group. Anyway, that's enough of my rant about email, so I'm sure we'll have more to talk about a little bit later. We're going to go to a short music track for another minute or so, and then we'll come back to speak to Jim Harris. Stay tuned. We are back. I'm Darren Kaster there. And I just looked at the time. I didn't realize that I actually went on... Kevin and I went on a bit of a rant there for a little while. So I've unfortunately had poor Jim Harris sitting on the phone waiting for us. Are you still there, Jim?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for your patience. I'm sorry we got a little bit carried away there for a minute.
No problem. I understand completely.
Just a lot of strong emotions today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on the program. We spoke a while ago, and I was really we had a really great talk when I talked to you on the phone before. So I was hoping we could get you on. So people have been listening to me talk for almost 20 minutes now. Maybe you'd be so kind as to introduce yourself.
Well, I'm the former leader of the Green Party of Canada, and a passionate environmentalist.
And you've done quite a bit of public speaking. You've put out a couple of books as well. We have here in front of me, there's a Blindsided was one. Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste was another. What are you doing these days since you're no longer involved with the Green Party?
Well, I still am involved with the Green Party in the sense that I'm a member and a donor, and I'm working to support Mike Schreiner's bid to win the first Green seat in Ontario. He's running in Guelph, and he's got a great chance to win that seat. In 2008, the party was tied for first place in the federal by-election in the last week of the election, and then the day before we went to the polls, Harper canceled that by-election and turned it into a general. So I know it's a winnable riding, and Mike has a great shot. So I'm still involved with the party, but just not doing the really intense work that I did for 8 years as the leader of the Green Party of Canada and the national campaign chair.
You're still very much involved with sort of being a people person professionally, almost it was. I don't know if that was too many P's in a sentence, but one of the things that I immediately noticed after our brief conversation a little while ago getting organized for this interview was that you very much like to sort of draw from your personal experience and make examples out of that. And I know some of the stuff that you've been doing have been consulting with, doing things like consulting with businesses and trying to help them encourage a sustainable way of thinking. Is that how you would put it?
Yeah, very much. Going green has huge benefits financially, cutting costs, raising revenue, and mitigating risk. So, for instance, just in a single year by focusing on energy efficiency of its trucking fleet, Walmart was able to save $200 million because they drive 1 billion miles a year and have the second largest fleet of trucks in the U.S. So simply putting a skirt on the truck, and a skirt is a metal cladding that goes down from the truck to just above the pavement, but it cuts down airflow, churn of air, and increases fuel efficiency by 6%. So when you're doing 1 billion miles a year, a 6% improvement in fuel efficiency has huge economic benefits. So cutting costs, it's all about becoming more efficient. So you don't even have to talk about green. It makes business sense to be efficient and eliminate waste.
And so you gave, I think, a really good example there of say, like a bigger company. And people, I think, a lot of time will hear about, you know, Walmart trying to be sustainable, and a lot of people will roll their eyes. And I think that particular company, just to pick on them for a second, has definitely been guilty of some greenwashing to some extent. I've seen reports about them, but as you're saying, a lot of the time this isn't about, you know, necessarily going out and convincing them to redevelop every single one of their products, but simply about, like, well, here's some places where, you know, you have a massive footprint, and Walmart has a, you know, one of the largest truck fleets, you were saying, and just something that will save them money also happens to be good for the environment. Have you found a lot of traction with this argument, as far as, like, have you found it easy to convince people that this is actually the case, or do people tend to be resistant?
Well, people really don't realize how much efficiency we can wring out of the system. Sears, for instance, a year or 2 years ago, retrofitted 130,000 incandescent light bulbs that were focused on retail displays to accent them. They changed them to LEDs. It was a $4.5 million project that had a 13-month payback. Now, show me where in a recessionary market, if you were to invest $4.5 million, you'd get that $4.5 million back every year from now to eternity. And are you going to try and tell me that that's not the best thing since sliced bread for a business person?
Hmm.
So we have a lot of false information, in part because of, I was listening to the prior discussion involving the Harper government. When John Baird was Minister of the Environment, he said before a Senate committee that meeting our Kyoto goals would manufacture the worst recession since the Great Depression. And in fact, nothing can be further from the truth. Companies like McKinsey have shown that there's a couple $1 trillion of energy efficiency initiatives that are highly profitable, available worldwide, but aren't being taken advantage of right now. So imagine $2 trillion of investment that would have a positive payback that isn't being done. So we've been sold a false, we've been lied to, that going green is expensive or would bankrupt you, when in fact the opposite is true.
Hi, Jim. This is Kevin. We've actually met. I was one of your candidates in the 2006 general election for the riding of St. Paul's in Toronto.
Always good to get that bias on record. Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's good for full disclosure. We've met. There's no way you would remember me, though. I'm interested in the strategy you're taking with motivating businesses to become green. And I'm wondering about the distinction between making a few green advancements and actually becoming a sustainable industry along the lines of what Ray Anderson did with Interface in the United States. And I'm wondering, are you pushing businesses to become sustainable, or are you just trying to, you know, sort of make some cost-efficient green adjustments to their business model?
Well, first off, Ray Anderson, before he died, would not have said that Interface was sustainable yet.
Now, no, they, but he had a plan to achieve 100% sustainability.
Yeah, they wanted to get to be a restorative company, in other words, where they absorb more carbon and toxins than they produce. So they're a net negative, so they're an absorber of these things. So not even interface is sustainable yet. So we can't say there are any sustainable companies. So the goal is to make all companies more sustainable. And there's no way that Walmart's sustainable if interface isn't sustainable. In fact, with Walmart, they end up on the list for companies that are the best in terms of doing making change, and they also consistently end up on the list for the worst. So it's paradoxical. And trucking isn't the solution, really. It's intermodal transportation, because transport by rail cuts the carbon footprint by 85% compared to trucking. So what we so you can make your trucks more efficient. You can save $200 million, but trucks aren't the way to go. So it's more sustainable, but when you have to look at the overall picture and say, hey, we actually have to move to intermodal, and the trucks are used for that last mile of transport.
One of the things I'd be really interested to hear your perspective on, and it would be normally the sort of thing where I would have maybe done an entire interview just on this topic, except that it's something that for me that I've been going to a lot of conferences and stuff recently, and I've met with quite a number of students here at the University of Toronto recently, and it's an issue that's just come up again and again and again. So I wondered if maybe I could put you on the spot a little bit and just get your two cents on that. A lot of people that I'm hearing's reaction to, like, for instance, when we're talking about, like, we'll continue using Walmart as the example, but they're of course, by no means the only company that has a large global impact. But when we're talking about, like, for instance, well, improving the trucks or, you know, increasing general overall sustainability, at the end of the day, there's still a company that sells things. And what a lot of people's concern is that it's not that we should be consuming all these products and then trying to make them as green, as less toxic as possible, as carbon neutral as possible. But increasingly, I'm hearing that a lot of people are just sort of fed up with the idea of consumerist culture, and that the answer isn't to have a greener product. It's, do we even need that product?
Yes, that's another wider discussion, which is, we are consuming globally 1.5 times what the Earth can produce. In other words, we're attacking the capital. We're not living off the interest.
Mm-hmm.
Or to put it another way, given in North America, we represent 5% of the world's population, but we consume 33% of the world's resources. So clearly, that is not sustainable. And we need to change that dramatically. But we live in this culture, and we need to celebrate our successes and create a momentum moving towards where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I, for instance, bought a Prius 8 years ago, and it cost me $4,000 more than the equivalent car would have been that wasn't a hybrid. But over the last 8 years, I've saved $18,000 with it in reduced fuel use. And over the next 8 years, I'll save another at least $18,000, meaning I will have saved the entire capital cost in the car over the time frame that I've used it. So if we want to change society, we need to show people how it's beneficial for them. I'll just give you an example. A lot of environmentalists like to use guilt as or negative framing as the way to drive change. And so as, you know, Greens, for instance, I was always concerned about the billions of plastic bags that went into landfill. So I campaigned for many years for cloth and string bags and so on. Well, we got to about 7% of the population doing this. Why? Because if I wanted to do the right thing 5 years ago, I had to buy a bag for $3. And every time I took it to the grocery store, I avoided double bagging. So at 3 cents a plastic bag, every week I saved that grocery store 6 cents. And over a year, I saved them $3. They got $3 of profit for my doing the right thing, and I paid $3. And then as environmentalists, we wonder why more people aren't doing it, because we're asking people to financially punish themselves. So we're financially punishing the right behavior, and we're financially rewarding those who are engaged in the wrong behavior. So the City of Toronto passed a bylaw that said you had to pay 5 cents a plastic bag. And you know, in 1 month, plastic bag use fell 70%. Well, why? Two reasons. One, there was such a demand for cloth bags that instead of $3 a bag, it went to 99 cents at most places. So as a consumer, I'd look at this cloth bag and say, hey, I can buy it for a buck. And if I use it because you put the double bag stuff in there for 10 weeks, I've earned back my money. So we sold in Toronto millions of cloth bags in the first month or two after that bylaw went in. And so all of a sudden we're rewarding people. They're getting a financial benefit for doing the right thing. So what we have to do as environmentalists is say, look, 30 years of working to change plastic bag use using guilt and negative framing got us 7% of the population. But once we had a marginal change in the economics, like 5 cents a bag is nothing if you're spending $200-$300 a week as a normal family on groceries. 5 cents a bag is nothing. This tiny little economic change had a 70% change in the market in 30 days. So 30 years of campaigning to get to 7% or 30 days to get to 70%. Which should we focus on?
So that, I mean, that puts us in an interesting spot. You have both experience, both being directly involved with and supporting politics and a political party, and then you also have quite a bit of business experience, both of your own and consulting and speaking to businesses. So I think you might be the perfect person to ask. You always get a million answers to this question, but I'd love to know yours. Where does the balance between private industry and government come to when you're trying to work out sustainability?
Well, they both have to be involved. It's a push and a pull. Businesses can actually act far faster than government can. And we need a balance of both. And I'll use a story in Toronto. 54% of the carbon footprint in Toronto is due to buildings. You know, we're in buildings 90% of our time. We work in them. Our homes are buildings. So if you want to change the carbon footprint of Toronto, focus on buildings. And for the residential sector, 90% of new homes in Toronto are condos. So the Toronto Atmospheric Fund in Toronto focused on green condos, and they defined a green condo as being 25% more energy efficient than the average Canadian condo. So the developer that they initially worked with, Tridel, didn't want to put $3,000 of upgrades, green upgrades, in the condos because they were worried about the purchase price that first-time home buyers might get a sticker shock with. So, you know, more efficient windows, appliances, low flush devices, shower, faucets, etc. Well, so they went to TAF and said, look, you give us a $500,000 loan, we'll match it with a $500,000 investment of ourselves. That'll be $1 million. We'll put in the green upgrades into every unit of this new development, and we'll sell them at the regular sticker price. So look at this. For the buyer, they get $3,000 of upgrades for free. That's great for first-time buyers who are sustainability sensitive. Mm-hmm. And the payment for them came out of the reduced operating ongoing expenses. So they saved on energy, electricity and gas and everything as a condo owner, but they didn't end up taking all that savings. They left some of it for the homeowner. So look at this. The homeowner gets the same purchase price with $3,000 of upgrades. They get cheaper operating costs, and once the 75% of that savings is paid the loan after 7 years, their operating costs drop even further. So it's a win-win-win. It's a win for the buyer. It's a win for the developer. They sold out like hotcakes, okay? So then their competitors start going to TAF, Toronto Atmospheric Fund, saying, hey, give us a $500,000 loan. They do that. Well, once 51% of all new condos were this green standard, the leading developers went to city council and said, why is your lax standard supporting the laggards who are polluting the planet? why don't you make this the minimum entry standard? So the leaders used it to kick the laggard where it hurt as a competitive advantage. So City Council passed that bylaw, and now every condo in Canada, or in Toronto, sorry, must be 25% more efficient than the Canadian average. So now the green loan program for TAF is 40% more efficient. So this is where you can use private business. You have to break the barriers. You have to get a lead group and tip the market. And once the market is tipped, you can make the whole market.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the things that came up in one of my classes when we were talking about green building was that it was the very thing that you were talking about, which is where the actual person, because there's like a developer and an actual builder and an architect, and there's so many different people involved. It's not like a home where there's a single home buyer and they go and contract somebody to design and then build their home, and there might be a designer, there might be an architect and a builder and construction, all these different things, but it's all coming down to the same person, the client. But that's not really how it works when we're talking about, for instance, condo towers, which is where there may be a contractor and a builder and a developer, but they all sort of pass money in between each other before the actual buyer does. So the person who could reap the benefits of, say, the environmental things like a heat exchange system or something like that, the ultimate building owner that then rents to clients, isn't the person that can save money from it. And so a lot of these things, and so it's just a matter of where it's like, in general, in theory, everybody involved in the chain of the process could be interested in this green technology, but because the right money isn't making it to the right hands, everybody at the end of the day just has to look out for their pocketbook. Do you think that this is that one of the major problems? Is it a fact where maybe do we already have people who are on board and they just don't have the tools required to do some of these initiatives?
Well, yes. I mean, it's the classic problem of owners and renters. In Toronto, we have a lot of old apartment buildings. I was just listening to David Miller and Karen Farbridge, the mayor of Guelph, at an event on Thursday night. And in Toronto, we have all these old buildings that are leaking heat.
Actually, Jim, you know what? I'm super sorry. I shouldn't have even gotten into that question. I just realized we've got about 30 seconds left. I'm so sorry.
Well, I'll just finish it quickly. Sure. These buildings could be reskinned or clad with... But the owners would have to pay for it when it's the renters who get lower cost of electricity and heat. So you have to break the owner-renter barrier, and we can actually do that and create 30,000 jobs in Toronto and literally save millions of dollars for tenants. So we can actually figure this out.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time to talk to you. I'm afraid we don't, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, we'll see you then.